This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The United Nations says more than 150 women and girls in South Sudan have been sexually assaulted in recent days. And the U.S. Embassy in the DRC reopened today, more than a week after shutting down due to a terrorist threat.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Cameroon is the recipient of a new public health emergency center constructed with the support of the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency. The facility, which provides training for hospital staff and helps to detect disease outbreaks, was inaugurated yesterday by Cameroon's Prime Minister. Moki Edwin Kinzigar reports from Yaoundé.
Prime Minister Philemon Yang says the Yaoundé Public Health Emergency Operations Center will enable Cameroon to meet the objectives of the Global Health Security Agenda. The GHSA was launched in 2014 with the goal of making the world safe and secure from infectious disease threats.
We require the continuous availability of detection capacities and the rapid deployment of operational teams, as well as drugs and adequate logistics. This Public Health Emergency Operations Center is at the heart of this mechanism.
Cameroon joined the United States and 28 other nations as founding members of GHSA. The government committed itself to improving food safety to prevent the emergence and spread of drug-resistant organisms and to reduce the number and magnitude of infectious disease outbreaks. The new Emergency Operations Center cost $3.5 million to build. The U.S. Ambassador to Cameroon, Peter Henry Ballerin, said the U.S. has also assisted Cameroon through the construction of a national public health laboratory, development of Ebola and cholera preparedness plans, and supported the national surveillance systems in public and animal health.
The important thing is to be able to react quickly and efficiently, and this operations center will give Cameroon the opportunity to do that and to coordinate among different regions and with international authorities.
Dr. Etundi Mbala, head of disease control in Cameroon's Ministry of Public Health, says neighbors like Gabon, Chad, Equatorial Guinea and Central African Republic will also benefit from the services of the new center. He says threats of infectious diseases that loom over Central Africa and affect mostly the poor include cholera, measles, yellow fever, polio and tetanus.
Il est important que le Cameroun sache détecter très précocement ces risques.
He says the Public Health Emergency Operations Center the people of America have helped Cameroon to construct will enable the Central African States health officials to detect disease outbreaks at the earliest possible moment, respond effectively with eradication or riposte methods to save the lives of not only Cameroonians, but the people of the entire Central African sub-region. Cameroon has so far avoided the Ebola outbreaks that have hit several other African countries, but experienced a cholera outbreak in July that killed at least a dozen people. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The United Nations says more than 150 women and girls in South Sudan have been sexually assaulted in recent days. The attacks were carried out by armed men, many in uniform, near the northern city of Bentiu, according to UN statement issued yesterday. The aid group Doctors Without Borders said last week that 125 women and girls have been sexually assaulted and robbed while walking to a food distribution site in Bentiu. A spokesman for the South Sudan People's Defense Forces told VOA reporter Winnie Sirino in Juba that its forces are not responsible for the attacks and that it is investigating the reports. Brigadier General Lul Ruai Koang says some of the attackers may have come from a nearby UN mission compound or that they may be opposition forces entering the area. Last month, parties to South Sudan's 5-year civil war signed a peace deal, ending the power struggle between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar.
This week, the U.S. is honoring former President George H.W. Bush, who died Friday at the age of 94. Following the end of the Cold War, President Bush introduced the notion of a new world order, free of the threat of terror, in pursuit of peace and justice. He faced the first challenge to that notion in Somalia when he sent U.S. troops to prevent famine. Ambassador David Mack served under President Bush as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the landmarks of the late president's term and the impact that Somalia experiences left on American presidents after him.
I think the historians are going to focus on his successful management of the ending of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States and the new distribution and balance of powers in Europe. The Europe that he inherited was dominated by the Cold War, and the Europe he left behind was one that was progressing with relative unity, including unity between the two Germanies. But in the Middle East, where I was particularly involved, it will obviously be dominated by two events, Desert Shield and Desert Storm, his successful opposition to Iraqi aggression against Kuwait, and the ejection of Iraqi forces from Kuwait. That was the first. And the second was the Madrid Conference and setting up a framework for negotiating Arab-Israeli peace, something that was successful for a number of years thereafterwards.
Former President George H. Bush introduced the notion of a new world order free of the threat of terror in pursuit of peace and justice. He faced the first challenge to this notion in Somalia when he sent U.S. troops in Operation Restore Hope to prevent famine in the war-torn country. How did this experience affect the worldview of succeeding American presidents?
President Bush responded with very good spirit to a humanitarian challenge that was taking place in Somalia with huge suffering by the population. And we had forces in the region because of the preceding Desert Storm operation. And he used those forces for a humanitarian operation in Somalia. And I think that that was a natural and good humanitarian response. As the soldiers stayed on, Somali factions began to believe that it was an attempt to change the nature of their politics. And as a result, there began to be a lot of opposition to the soldiers, not to their humanitarian operation so much as their very presence. As a result, President Clinton, during the 8 years of his presidency, kept reflecting on the fact that the operation had ended with the deaths of American soldiers. For that reason, President Clinton was very reluctant to use U.S. military forces abroad in any number of cases that occurred throughout the world where you might have thought about beginning it for humanitarian purposes, such as the genocide in Central Africa. But you would always remind yourself that it could end up with clashes between local factions and U.S. military forces.
So what kind of legacy did President George H. Bush leave behind?
I think he left behind a model of how one could approach foreign policy with restraint, using your military forces and other resources in a very calculated and carefully moderate way, to do it with a maximum backing from other nations, do it in a multinational way, avoid shows of unilateral U.S. military force, and particularly do not humiliate an adversary and treated adversaries with a certain degree of respect, even if he didn't particularly like them sometimes.
That was Ambassador David Mack, who served under President Bush. He spoke with our colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy. President Bush's body is lying in state today in the U.S. Capitol before his funeral ceremony tomorrow.
The U.S. Embassy in the Democratic Republic of Congo reopened today, more than a week after shutting down due to a terrorist threat. Yesterday, a U.S. official told VOA the threat came from a group affiliated with Islamic State militants. The U.S. official, speaking on condition of anonymity, was unable to say whether the group's members were Congolese nationals or from outside the country. The State Department has declined to comment on the threat, which had kept the embassy closed since November 26th. Yesterday, the State Department said the embassy determined it's safe to reopen and return to normal staffing. However, consular services today are by appointment only. The DRC is weeks away from a long-anticipated presidential election. President Joseph Kabila's term expired in 2016, but elections have been delayed for a number of reasons. They will be held December 23rd.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Cameroon is the recipient of a new public health emergency center constructed with the support of the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency. This week, the U.S. is honoring former President George H.W. Bush, who died at age 94. And the U.S. Embassy in the Democratic Republic of Congo reopened today, more than a week after shutting down due to a terrorist threat. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Nigeria's Universal Basic Education Commission says there are at least 13.2 million children out of school in the country. The figure was recently released after analyzing the data. The number was up from 10.5 million in 2010. The commission says many factors contribute to the increase, including the Boko Haram insurgency and rising birth rates. The Nigerian government has not reacted to the report. Dr. Raphael James is an educator and media researcher in Lagos who studies the issue. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the implications of the increase in out-of-school children.
Well, actually it is, because if we're having 30 million kids who are supposed to be in school to be out of school, that's a serious crisis in the hand of the government and people of Nigeria. At this rate, we're going to have a situation where in the next couple of years, we're going to have more people drawing the country backwards because they don't have proper education. And I think something has to be done about it, and it has to be done immediately.
What should the government, aid agencies, and relevant bodies do to send the children back to school?
In the olden days, back in the 40s and 50s, even some of the people who are presently in government, they all had free education then that they attended. I think government should actually take it upon themselves. Recently, I understand the government came up with this policy of breaking down, cutting down costs of JAMB and all that. But I think beyond that, they should introduce free education, at least at the primary school level. This will encourage more people to go to school.
Some educationists and development experts have suggested that children affected by the Boko Haram war be given special classes in internally displaced camps. Do you agree?
Yes, I totally agree to that. It's just like the same thing that happened during the Nigerian Civil War. During the Civil War, some of the Biafran kids were given special classes because, of course, they can't be in class when there's a war. The same thing that is happening with the Boko Haram, the areas affected by Boko Haram presently. So special classes should be introduced to encourage them to learn during the period of the crisis.
Some scholars have blamed government officials in northern Nigeria for not doing enough to encourage children to go to school. What's your take on this?
It has been an ongoing thing. It's not new. Let me give you a practical example. The current presidential candidate under the PDP, Atiku Abubakar, for example, at a point in time in his life, his father was sentenced to prison because he did not allow him to go to school. But now, I wish the father was alive to see that that same boy he didn't allow to go to school is now running to become the president of Nigeria. It's just a change of orientation. Let them understand that education is needed. Education is not taking them backwards. It's actually going to improve them. So the people of the northern area should do all they can to encourage their wards and their kids to acquire Western education.
How does Boko Haram threat affect education for children in neighboring countries such as Cameroon, Chad, and Niger? Are they also seeing a similar problem?
On that one, let me mention something. I don't know how correct am I, but let me tell you this. Do you believe that because of the crisis happening in the northern area, some of these neighboring countries, their kids do migrate into Nigeria? There are high chances of that. And when things like this happen, we group all of them now as Nigerians. But this actually is not true. They are all not Nigerians. They are immigrants who have come into the country because our borders are open. Because of the crisis that are going on. So I think presently the United Nations and the other agencies that are involved should come together and put up more schools, put up more infrastructures in these areas to encourage these kids to acquire education. And when necessary, provide food, because I mean, no hungry child is going to go to school. We're having situations where we see most of them are living in hunger. So let them provide enough food, provide a convenient environment for them, and provide good education for them.
That was educator Raphael James speaking with journalist Mike Mbonye in Lagos.
Nairobi's government has backed down again on its ban of matatu buses from the central business district as part of plans to ease what it calls the Kenyan capital's monster traffic. Nairobi Governor Mike Sonko cited the suffering faced by commuters, business people, and matatu operators yesterday when the buses were turned away from the city center. But he said officials have to find ways to ease traffic congestion. This was the sixth effort since 2014 to restrict matatus in Nairobi. But the matatu organizations have significant clout and have managed to fend off the government's efforts. 21 of them filed suits yesterday over the new ban. Sonoko said today he suspended the ban to let all parties try to work out an alternative solution. He urged increased use of carpooling and tighter controls over traffic violations to ease the chaos.
A group of young female business owners in Guinea-Bissau have banded together to increase their business knowledge. They say the cooperation is increasing sales. Ricky Shryock reports from The Nation.
From street vendors to women who own their own shops, Adele Gomes likes to encourage young female entrepreneurs in Guinea-Bissau. Gomes is president of the Young Women Entrepreneurs Group in Bissau, the capital. She wants to encourage young women in the West African country to expand their businesses and become financially independent. Gomes says they created the association because they felt weak, and by banding their ideas together, they can be stronger. They are a small group of about 12 women who own a variety of businesses, from clothing design to event planning. This month marks the group's one-year anniversary. The group organizes an annual exposition in Bissau to showcase the members' products. They also cross-promote each other's brands on social media. Gomes says her business and other members' sales have seen increases since creating the association. This means more people are eager to join, she adds. Adele Dos Santos, another fashion designer, is huddled over her sewing machine, filling orders. She says her sales have gone up too. As a woman, this can sometimes lead to distinct challenges, she adds. Adele, who has a daughter, is expected to not only provide financially, but also manage her household. Sometimes family and other members of the community criticize them for spending too much time working and not enough time at home, she says. Part of the problem is that Guinea-Bissau, one of the least developed countries in the world, doesn't have enough jobs for men and young people. Local economist Augusta Enriquez says any development projects in the West African country must address high youth unemployment. According to Enriquez, if you give all the economic responsibility to women and the youth have no prospects, the entire weight will fall to women. That is a very heavy burden, she adds. For now, the young women entrepreneurs hope they can help each other carry the load. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Bissau, Guinea-Bissau.
The United Nations is launching a $21.9 billion humanitarian appeal for 2019 to help nearly 94 million people in 42 countries survive conflict, hunger, homelessness, deprivation, and the impact of climate change. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the appeal in Geneva.
The United Nations says it expects its 2019 appeal will reach a record-breaking high of $25 billion after serious humanitarian needs are fully assessed early next year. The beneficiaries of the appeal constitute the most vulnerable of nearly 132 million people across the globe. More than one-fifth of the funds requested, or $4 billion, will go to Yemen, which the United Nations considers the world's worst humanitarian crisis. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Lowcock says conditions in Yemen are worsening. He says 24 million people, or 75% of the population, will need humanitarian assistance next year.
The UN is planning to meet the needs of 15 million of those people. And that includes providing emergency food assistance to 12 million people. Other countries where the situation has deteriorated include Afghanistan, because of the mixture of drought, instability and security, the economic challenges and so on, and Cameroon and the Central African Republic, where we've seen an upsurge of conflict and violence.
The United Nations reports donors have provided a record $13.9 billion in humanitarian aid last year. While welcoming this generosity, UN officials say this still represents a significant funding gap in the $20 billion requested for 2018. Lowcock notes the lion's share of money from the current appeal will provide life-saving aid for people caught in conflict situations. But he adds an increasing number of the recipients will be victims of natural disasters. He says scientists forecast an 80% chance of an El Nino next year. This event, he says, could precipitate or worsen drought, floods, and tropical cyclones in 25 countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the role of political parties in Africa. Is there room for opposition political groups? Does the African citizen have a right to form an independent opinion? Those issues and more on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.